The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth. Joining me today is Anthony Sanders. He's an IJ senior attorney and the director of IJ's Center for Judicial Engagement. In that capacity, Anthony educates the public and often other lawyers about the vitally important role that judges have in enforcing the Constitution. That means part of Anthony's job is paying attention to issues that the legal community is talking about and finding a way to inject IJ's view of the law and the Constitution into the conversation. It also means bringing IJ's issues to that community. In today's show, we're going to dive into a few of the issues that are hot at the moment. But first, Anthony, can we start by talking about the Center for Judicial Engagement, what it is that you're doing and how you do it?
Yes. So the Center for Judicial Engagement is IJ's effort to educate the public about the central role judges play in enforcing the Constitution. We want people to realize that the government can't be automatically deferred to on trusting whether or not something is constitutional. Judges need to place a party who's litigating against the government on an even basis with the government on deciding whether or not a law is unconstitutional.
So how do you do that? Is that something that you just go around and talk to judges about, or?
Sure. So we have a number of ways that we try to get the word out. We have a podcast. Now, many of you are familiar with our Short Circuit podcast that talks about a few cases from the week on a biweekly basis. We have
and
the Short Circuit.
If they're not, they should be.
Yeah, absolutely. And should sign up today. Shortcircuit.org. We also have our Short Circuit newsletter that goes out every week. We have a long-running podcast called Bound by Oath, which is in its inaugural season. Well, season two has just been approved. That will come out next year. And season one is a very deep look into the origins and the application of the 14th Amendment. We also put on conferences where we ask members of the bar and the outside community and even judges to come to the conferences and talk about these very important issues of our time and of the Constitution.
Well, let's start talking about a couple of those ourselves. I wanted, because this is the podcast where we get nerdy, you know, about IJ issues, I wanted to start with what I thought was the nerdiest of all of the topics that you and I had discussed, and that is something called national injunctions. So why are people talking about national injunctions?
Yes.
How is this coming up?
Well, it's talked about so much, you might even think it's not so nerdy anymore, although a lot of the talk about it is not very descriptive of what the issue actually is. So a national injunction is where a judge issues an order that applies to the entire country. And you might think, well, what's the big deal about a national injunction? Really what a national injunction is when people are talking about it is what's called a universal injunction. And that's an order that a judge gives that applies beyond just the people who are in the courtroom about, or in that case, about whether or not a law can be applied. So if I go into court and I say this new law that Congress has just passed is unconstitutional and the court should order that it not be applied because it violates the Constitution, and the judge enjoins that law from being applied to people other than just myself because I'm the only person in the lawsuit, that would be called a universal injunction.
Okay, and how is this coming up in the news then? What are some of the issues that are bringing it to the fore right now or even in the past few years?
So universal injunctions have been around for a long time. It's only become a big deal in the last couple administrations because I think litigants have gotten savvy enough and a lot of state attorney generals have gotten savvy enough that they file their a lawsuit about a new regulation or new statute and try to get it enjoined. And that happened under Obama quite a bit by Republican attorney generals. And now it's happening under the Trump administration with Democratic attorney generals. That's how it becomes a big issue. But the central question is just that if you go into court and you convince a judge that a law is unconstitutional or illegal or it can't be enforced, should that order go beyond just the person suing? And IJ's position is that, yes, in a lot of circumstances, it makes sense that it goes beyond the person suing. Otherwise, everyone who doesn't want to have to obey an unconstitutional law, which I hope would be a lot of people if the law really is unconstitutional, is going to have to go into court and have that law not apply to them. And so having a universal injunction that a judge issues is a way to short circuit everyone having to go to court to get relief from a law that is unconstitutional.
Well, it sounds very reasonable. So what is the controversy then? Why is that something that people are talking about at all if it makes so much sense?
Right. And there is a legitimate debate in the academic community about whether the powers that the Constitution gives to judges should go beyond just the parties who are involved. And this goes back to what the courts of equity in the 18th century had the power to do and a lot of legal minutiae. But it's something that has been used for a long time. Today, it shouldn't be controversial as much as it is. If we look at, say, an injunction in a state, this is not a big deal at all. If you say California passes a law and someone goes into federal court and tries to have that law enjoined because it violates the Constitution, that's not nearly as big as an issue as if you go into court to have a nationwide rule enjoined. But it's really the same principle. And so it's been a bigger deal at a nationwide level because there's just more land, frankly. And so if you have a ruling by one judge in one state, it has an impact across the entire country. And there is a legitimate concern that, well, that takes away the Supreme Court's power of resolving splits between different circuits, different parts of the court jurisdictions in the country about whether or not this law actually is unconstitutional lot or valid or not. But that's getting at the minutiae of how the judiciary operates, and Congress could actually address that in some ways. The basic principle about whether a judge can order the government to stop doing something that's unconstitutional beyond just the person who's in that lawsuit shouldn't be controversial.
And presumably, even if a lower court judge does issue an injunction, the Supreme Court would still have the opportunity to weigh in, right?
That's right.
If it's appealed, perhaps?
This is really only an issue when it is in a lower court. Once an issue gets to a Supreme Court, or say if it's under a state constitution, a state Supreme Court, that ruling, whether it's an injunction or just the reasoning of the court, is going to apply everywhere. The danger if we didn't have injunctions like this, is say a court rules that a law is unconstitutional, but it only applies to the person who sued the government, and then the government says, okay, we won't appeal that, but we're going to keep applying it to everyone else. And then the next person has to go in and file a lawsuit, and they say, okay, we won't appeal yours, but we're going to apply it to everyone else. And they would never have binding precedent preventing the government from doing that in the future. That's the real danger if we did away with universal injunctions, as some people have irresponsibly asked to happen.
So does IJ use these injunctions? Is that a—
Absolutely.
It seems like that would be a great way to extend the impact of any case pretty quickly. So is that something we do as a matter of routine or only occasionally?
It's something we ask for in many of our cases, which is an injunction to prevent the government from continuing to do the unconstitutional thing that we're suing about.
So moving on to another topic, almost as hot, maybe a little bit more accessible, housing prices.
Yes.
So this is obviously something that journalists are talking about, that politicians and pundits and academics are talking about for a whole bunch of different reasons and in different ways. It may come up at Thanksgiving tables, like what are we going to do about these crazy housing prices here in D.C. or in San Francisco? What does the law have to say about that, though? Why is that something that CJE would talk about at all?
Yeah, well, this is something that everyone can relate to because it's really just a basic principle of math. And in fact, there's a broad coalition of people on the left and the right who get this and get that there needs to be something done about it. So if you have high housing prices in an area, there's a good chance that the housing prices are that high because you don't have more housing units, right? Supply and demand, pretty basic stuff. Now, in a lot of areas, there aren't more housing units, whether they're apartments or homes or whatever, because there's legal restrictions on how many can be made. Now, sometimes this is environmental restrictions, such as there's, you know, some wetlands that you can't drain and build more houses on. But a lot of the times, it comes down to zoning rules. And now most people kind of know what zoning is. It means you can't do some things in one part of town, but you can do them in another part of town. The trouble is a lot of our cities and suburbs, but even big cities like parts of Seattle and San Francisco, to take a couple examples, they have what's called single family zoning, which means in this area of land, you can only build a single family house. Only one household can live on that lot. You can't build a duplex. You can't build a big apartment building. If that's true, you can't get that many units of housing in that area of land. So people get that. That's pretty relatable. Now, the trouble is that challenging that in court is incredibly difficult. Because zoning, a long time ago in a Supreme Court case from 1926 called Euclid, zoning was pretty much put outside of the Constitution. Zoning is constitutional. If you want to change your individual lot and do something else with it and you're in the wrong zone, tough. There's no way to challenge that.
Under the federal constitution,
it is just very hard. So the court said that's just going to be okay for the government to do. It's within its police power. And over the years, the case law has only gotten worse about that. So one way to solve the housing crisis in these areas is to say, okay, you can build a duplex. You can rent your basement out. You could build a bigger apartment building. But there's a lot of resistance to this, NIMBYism, not in my backyard, it's often called. And there's a big push now to reform this legislatively, which is great. And California's moved forward on that. The city where I work, Minneapolis, Minnesota, has actually gotten rid of single-family zoning legislatively, which is great. But there's a lot of places where that's not moving forward and it's not going to be able to move forward because of NIMBYism. And so that's where we could really use some help brought by judges engaging with the Constitution. It's pretty much off the table for now under the federal Constitution, but in a lot of states, there could be challenges made under state constitutions that give a little higher of a standard for property rights. And so that's a push that IJ is involved with and other organizations are involved with right now and trying to use property rights to bring more affordable housing to people.
And the challenges under state constitutions, has that been done since Euclid anywhere? Or?
It's been done haphazardly and not in a big way, but there are some promising signs that it could be done elsewhere. There's been a lot of litigation over the years in New Jersey.
Just about everything. So it's no surprise that this is
that's
one.
That's right. And that's been somewhat successful, the push in New Jersey. It hasn't been done as much elsewhere, but there are signs of hope out there that we're hoping people use to use in addition to the legislative reform that's being pushed to solve this housing crisis with the expansive use of single-family zoning.
Do you get the sense that because of the policy interest, because of the acceptance that this is contributing, these zoning policies are contributing to the problem, how does that influence the way that judges might look at this? Are they in kind of a legal bubble where they look only at Euclid and maybe some other decisions, or are, you know, do these broader conversations sometimes factor into the way that they decide things like this?
Well, the more that judges understand the policy issues and the more that judges understand what's going on outside of their own circles, and that could be true of any class of human beings, but it's especially true of judges, the more they're going to understand that what has been happening isn't working and that there's all kinds of reasons why our constitutional approach to zoning for the last 100 years, which has pretty much been anything goes that the government wants to do, is not going to be sustainable.
Well, so speaking of state constitutions, we actually have at IJ a couple of cases that are really pushing the envelope on the kinds of economic liberty claims that can be made under state constitutions. And a few of those have sort of percolated pretty high right now. And I thought that would be, you know, a nice thing to talk about, especially as you, from your position, looking at the things that people are talking about in the legal community more broadly, can discuss about how they fit in with the broader trend on state constitutions and kind of where we hope to see things go. So to start, the highest court in Maryland, not called the Supreme Court, which always confuses people, the Court of Appeals of Maryland, is going to hear an IJ case about a vending law. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that it matters that that's happening under a state constitution?
Yeah. So for a few years now, we've been litigating this case in Baltimore, where we have a couple great clients who have these food trucks. And the law says you cannot park a food truck within 300 feet of a business that sells a similar product. Obviously, the only reason for that law is to protect that other business that's less than 300 feet away. So we challenged this law and said that under the Maryland Constitution, it is not related to a legitimate governmental interest. This law is unconstitutional. We didn't win on that grounds, but we went on a related claim that the law was too vague at the trial court. That then went to the intermediate court, where the intermediate court said it was perfectly constitutional. We then asked the high court to take it, which it now has. We just filed our first brief the other day. And if you want to find it on our website and you're really interested in 17th century English law and the roots of our right to earn a living, I'd recommend it to you. And that will be argued in the coming months. We also have another case in Georgia where we're challenging a licensing restriction on people who give advice to young mothers about how to breastfeed their babies. And this has been licensed. And there are 800 of these women across the state of Georgia who depend on doing this advice to young mothers for their income. And they were going to be put out of work overnight because of this new law. So we've challenged that, and that is going to the Georgia Supreme Court. We had a case a few years ago, many of you may remember, in Texas, where we had a victory in 2015 at the Texas Supreme Court about a cosmetology licensing law. And in all of these cases, what we're asking the court to do is to say that, well, the federal courts may have said economic liberty is very, very, very hard to be protected under the federal constitution. But under the state constitution, there's a higher standard that protects the right to earn a living, and that the government needs to have a little bit more of evidence and more better reasoning for why a law is actually connected to public health, safety, or welfare before we can call it constitutional. And so we're very much looking forward to these cases to see if we can do in there what we did in Texas.
Are there any other states other than the Texas where we really did establish such a strong precedent for entrepreneurs that are similarly protective, or is Texas really the leader right now? And these Georgia and Maryland have a chance to be number two in line in terms of looking after the economic rights of their citizens.
Well, Texas is where we have done it. IJ has done it, but many other states have precedent that's like what we established in Texas, that there's a higher standard. And in fact, one of them is Georgia, another is Maryland, where these two cases are right now. Now, we want that expanded and greater clarified, but there are many states that have a tradition of having a little bit better protection than the U.S. Supreme Court has done since the New Deal.
So the sort of housing zoning issue, the economic issue that IJ is really so active in, are there other issues sort of percolating under state constitutions right now that you're seeing as you survey the landscape, or are these, does that really sort of encapsulate where the changes are happening?
Oh, there's always lots going on under state constitutions. The economic liberty, of course, is a big one, but another one is property rights. And it's now been 14 years since the Kelo case, the infamous Kelo case, where the U.S. Supreme Court said pretty much anything is a public use for eminent domain. But since then, in the years since then, we've had several state Supreme Courts saying, not in our state, that we don't have that standard for public use in our state. And that is only going to continue into the future until Kelo is eventually overturned. State Supreme Courts will be where we can prevent local governments from taking people's land for private gain.
Well, and we actually were just at, you know, on the property rights issue, we were actually just at the state Supreme Court in Indiana on another issue that's really developing a lot in the lower courts. And I know that you have written about and others at IJ are very involved in, which is the imposition of these outrageous fines and fees schemes, excessive forfeitures. Can you talk a little bit about the Indiana case, which I suspect some of the listeners will sound a little bit familiar.
Yeah, well, that is, of course, the case of our good friend Tyson Timbs and his Land Rover that went to the U.S. Supreme Court last year. And earlier this year, the Supreme Court said that he got the benefit of the protection of the excessive fines clause of the Eighth Amendment, which 2019 was, it wasn't until then that it was ruled that actually applies to the states. 150 years since the Civil War, we finally got a ruling that it applies to the states. So that ruling protected Tyson's property under the Eighth Amendment, but it didn't say whether or not he actually got his truck back. So what happened was we then argued to the Indiana Supreme Court, where the case was sent back down, that this was an excessive fine, that taking his property away, it was a forfeiture case for the minor drug crime that he had been convicted for, violated the Eighth Amendment. And what the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court there did is they said, well, they themselves didn't rule whether he got his truck back, but they gave a standard for what should be considered on whether or not there is an excessive fine, and that was now going down to the trial court. So we look forward to the completion of the case, but we're happy with that result because what the court said is that you can't have your property taken from you just because it was the instrumentality of a crime, just because it was used in some kind of crime. It still can be excessive to take that away from you. One example, my colleague Wesley Hoddit, who argued the case at the Supreme Court, put is they were trying to take his Land Rover away because he had this minor drug crime that had happened in the Land Rover, and he said, "Well, you know, could you take away his shoes? He had to wear his shoes to go and commit this minor crime. Could that be something you could constitutionally take away from someone?" And then the examples go on after that, but the what we liked about the ruling of the Indiana Supreme Court is that you need to look at the whole context. You need to look at whether someone has a lot of money or whether they're poor on whether a crime is excessive, which of course only makes sense. So we look forward to more cases like that on trying to distill what the standard is under the Eighth Amendment.
Well, thank you so much, Anthony, for joining us. Thank you for listening. With that, we're out of time. If you enjoyed this conversation, please don't forget to follow us and to subscribe.